This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Some cybersecurity experts think a Miami company whose software was exploited in a massive ransomware attack is downplaying the number of businesses affected. We get more from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Kaseya has been estimating the number of businesses compromised by the cyber attack is in the low thousands. But security experts say victims are still being identified, especially since the attack occurred over a long holiday weekend. Kaseya reports dozens of its affected customers are managed service providers, with multiple customers downstream. At least 17 countries were affected by the hack. Thousands of IT customers in Germany, 800 supermarkets in the Swedish co-op, more than 100 kindergartens in New Zealand, and two Dutch IT service companies. Kaseya is supposed to be issuing a security patch this week, and the White House is involved in trying to track down the culprits. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Top Biden administration officials hosted a brother to powerful Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Washington. Tuesday's meetings are the highest-level such visit since the U.S. made public intelligence findings linking the Saudi crown prince to the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration did not publicly disclose the visit by Saudi Deputy Defense Minister Khalid bin Salman in advance. President Biden pledged during his presidential campaign to make a pariah of the kingdom's crown prince over Khashoggi's killing and other abuses. His administration has instead emphasized U.S. strategic interest with Saudi Arabia. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Officials overseeing the search at the site of the Florida condominium collapse seem increasingly somber about the prospects for finding anyone alive. They say Tuesday that crews have detected no new signs of life in the rubble nearly 2 weeks after the disaster struck the tower south building in Surfside. Miami-Dade County Fire Chief Alan Kaminsky said search teams have not found anything positive, like livable spaces in the debris. While the effort is still officially called a search and rescue mission, the Miami-Dade mayor said that families of those still missing are preparing for news of tragic loss. Hurricane Elsa is expected to impact a broad portion of the southeast. AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
Elsa is a minimal hurricane. Top sustained winds of 75 miles per hour. National Hurricane Center Director Ken Graham says the expected path of the storm has it bumping along just off Florida's west coast into Wednesday morning, bringing high wind, storm surge, and heavy rain to the more than 3 million people in the Tampa Bay area.
The Tampa Bay metro area, Ruskin, you start getting really really close to these areas, St. Pete.
The storm is expected to come ashore north of the bay, then move from the southwest to the northeast across the state into coastal
Georgia later tomorrow afternoon, overnight through Georgia, and then by 2 p.m. on Thursday, we're up there in North Carolina.
I'm Tim McGuire.
South Korea is seeing a steep rise in coronavirus infections unseen since the worst of its outbreak last winter, while most of its people were still unvaccinated. The 1,212 new cases added Wednesday is near the country's pandemic high. Health experts say the government sent the wrong message to the public by pushing for a premature easing of social distancing despite a steadily rising caseload. The Prime Minister, Kim Bukim, said officials will consider tougher social distancing rules if transmissions continue to grow. He pleaded for public vigilance and said the situation was an emergency where we need to invest all of our abilities to respond. Authorities in a Chinese city bordering Myanmar locked down the city Wednesday as a fresh outbreak of COVID-19 expanded. Health authorities said another 15 cases were found in southwest China's prefecture on top of six in the first 2 days. Lockdown took effect at midnight. It required residents to stay at home and shut down all businesses and public institutions except hospitals, pharmacies, and essential shops like grocery stores. The positive cases include both Chinese and Myanmar nationals in the city, where there is an active border trade. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghana's main opposition party, Youth, demand justice for victims of police brutality.
Nobody's life today is safe in my country, Ghana. So that's why we said that the demonstrations should register our displeasure to the happenings in the country so that those criminals in the government security agencies should be punished and removed from our security agencies. That's the basic reason why we state the demonstration today.
President Buhari praises Nigerian security forces for their role leading to the arrest of an alleged terrorist. Cameroon accuses Central African Republic rebels of stealing cattle. Government-backed militias in Burkina Faso are accused of abuses. And Nigerians react to news of another kidnapping of students.
We risk the loss of a generation if these attacks on school and attacks on education continue. It is so shameful that on one hand, bandits and Boko Haram are attacking children and their right to education. On the other hand, the government's only response is to shut down schools.
And we'll tell you why an American-born swimmer will swim for Guinea-Bissau in the Summer Olympics. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Ghana, youth of the main opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC party, took to the streets in the capital Accra on Tuesday to demand justice for all persons they say have been killed or brutalized by security forces. Efo Wolanyo Seppo is an NDC regional youth organizer.
Changing the process was all about injustice happening in Ghana. Before the 2020 election, there was a by-election at one of our constituencies called Ayawaso West Wokon. Our representative in parliament passed on, so there was a by-election. And that by-election was characterized by bloodshed. And a presidential committee of inquiry was established to look into that particular incident. They brought a report and recommended that the police officer who was in charge of that operation was given for him to be sacked immediately, and then they added to be recommended. Up till now, nothing has been done. That motivated the party in government, the supporters who caused that, who did that, motivated them. And the same thing happened during the 2020 election in a constituency called Techiman, where four people were killed by state treaty agencies. That's one, too. There was nothing that was said by the president. So this called for we, those in opposition, the youth in opposition, to stage a demonstration to register our displeasure because the government is in charge of security. The government in power is in charge of security. That's in all the constituencies, all the 275 constituencies, and the nation at large. So if someone, we know that laws and others are made so that when someone does something wrong and is punished, it will serve as deterrent to others not to repeat that mistake again. Here's the case. People have been killed. People have been shot at. People are paralyzed because of actions of government officials. And nothing, absolutely nothing has been done to them, which encourage others to do same. That's why we state the demonstration as the youth of National Democratic Congress opposition party to register our displeasure because international communities are also watching. International communities also watching. They have their businesses here. If it continues now, they are shooting at us, we the natives. Our own government is stealing us. Our own government is beating us, paralyzing several people. If it's doing this to us, what about the expatriates who are doing business in Ghana? So nobody's life today is safe in my country, Ghana.
To what degree is this protest a part of the opposition dissatisfaction with the last election?
The outcome of the last election, you know, as I said, a lot of bloodshed were characterized by the 2020 election. We lost about 7 lives in that election. Blood was shed. We have about 14 people who have now been paralyzed. And all these things are public knowledge. I'm not the one concocting this story. They are all public knowledge out there that everybody can see. This is the first time in the history of Ghana. This is the first time since 1992, after our former president, John Rawlings, opted for the democratic rule. This is the first time we went into an election and 7 people were murdered, 7 people were killed, and nothing has been done. This is the first time we went to an election and about 14 people have been beaten to the extent that they are paralyzed. That's why we are doing this demonstration. And as we stated today, the protest is not just going to end today. We are going to do it. This is the national one we did. We are going to do the regional one in all the 16 regions. If nothing is done about it, we will go to the various constituencies and protest as well.
When you say you are protesting for justice, is it justice from police brutality or also for economic justice?
For now, you know, if you don't have our peace of mind, like if you don't stop the police brutality, the injustice, there is no way we can have a peace of mind to economically work on our businesses and then increase our gain. So the first one is for the police brutality to stop. You know, without peace, you can't go about your normal businesses. That was why I stated that we have your police, Americans in Ghana, who are not also because what is happening in Ejira, that coincidence. If it happens in Accra, both the expatriates and we, the natives, nobody is safe. So we are telling them that the one that is important, both are important, but the police brutality, we need peace and justice for those who are dead. So the police brutality must stop. The military brutality must stop. The military killings must stop.
Did you make any petition to the police to express your concerns?
Yes. After our demonstration, we made a petition to the presidency. That's the Jubilee House. Because he's the commander-in-chief. He was the one who set up a presidential commission. In the first instance that happened in the Ayawasu west of Wagon, one of the constituencies, that led to injury of lots of people by the security agency. So we laid one of the petitions at his doorstep, that's the presidency, and we sent a second petition to the Parliament House.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much, my brother.
Efo Wolayo Sepo is a regional youth organizer for Ghana's main opposition, National Democratic Congress, the NDC. He was speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has commended the country's security forces for their role in the execution of an international operation that led to the arrest last week of Nnamdi Kanu, leader of the indigenous people of Biafra. In a statement released on Tuesday, Senior Special Assistant to President Buhari, Galba Shehu, says Kanu was detained as a result of an international cross-border operation. He said Kanu was handed over to Nigerian intelligence agency and returned to Nigeria to face the law. The statement said the violence inspired by the indigenous people of Biafra has led to hundreds of fatalities, particularly targeted at government assets and law enforcement agency. President Buhari hopes that the professionalism displayed by the Nigerian security agencies will be sustained and brought to bear against bandits who have found a new trade of kidnapping students. Nigerian authorities in northwest Kaduna State have shut 13 schools after more than 140 students were kidnapped Monday from a Baptist high school. The closures are the latest after a string of armed attacks on schools that authorities say threatened to permanently damage Nigerian children's education. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Kaduna State Schools Quality Assurance Authority officials say a risk assessment shows the 13 schools are the most vulnerable to attacks. The attack on Bethel Baptist High School Monday is the latest in a spate of school kidnappings for ransom and the fourth such mass kidnapping in the state in 5 months. Kaduna authorities said 26 people, including a woman teacher, have been rescued and that troops are searching for missing kidnapped victims. But a local clergyman said an initial verification showed only 20 out of 180 students boarding at the school before the attack had been accounted for. Amnesty International's Sheung Bakari says attacks and school closures signal severe threats to education in Nigeria.
We risk the loss of a generation if these attacks on school and attacks on education continue. It is so shameful that on one hand, bandits and Boko Haram are attacking children and their right to education. On the other hand, the government's only response is to shut down schools. The government's response has also been an attack on the right to education, and this is something that is completely unacceptable.
The recent wave of kidnappings continues to worsen the education crisis in Nigeria's north, a region known for low levels of literacy and enrollment and accounting for more than 70% of Nigeria's school dropouts. Despite the government's pledge to secure the schools, critics say it is either unwilling or unable to fix the problem. Emmanuel Huande is a spokesperson at Nigerian Union of Teachers, NUT.
We don't want the government to make a mere pronouncement that they are on top of the situation. We want the government to take responsibility. We want the government to take actions that will abort such occurrences.
On Sunday, Gunmen also attacked a national tuberculosis and leprosy center and abducted 8 people, including an infant. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says 2.8 million children in the Northeast need education emergency support due to violence in the region. Unless addressed, experts say many more children will be risking a bleak future. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 7th. Cameroon officials are accusing rebels from the Central African Republic of crossing the border to steal cattle and abduct villagers for ransom. The officials said the Central African Republic rebels are fleeing the country to escape post-election violence. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Officials in Cameroon accuse CAR rebels of entering the country's territory and harassing civilians and others displaced by fighting in the neighboring country. Officials say the rebels then take cattle and food from Cameroonian ranchers and farmers. About 30 civilians were abducted in June with demands for family members to pay ransoms of between $1,000 to $10,000 per person to guarantee their safe return. Authorities say people suspected of collaborating with Cameroonian officials to denounce the rebels who are hiding in villages along the Cameroon border are also abducted and tortured in retaliation. Kildadi Tageke Buka is governor of the Adamawa region of Cameroon that shares a border with the CAR. He visited Mbere, an administrative unit in the Adamawa region, on Monday. He says Cameroon's President Paul Biya asked him to make sure that the military is deployed to protect host communities and people displaced by the fighting in the CAR. He spoke by the messaging app WhatsApp from Johong, a commercial town in Mbere.
The Mbere division shares more than 160 kilometers of border with Central Africa. And along this border, rebels encroach our territory, steal cows. We have come to reinforce the forces of law and order, encourage the population to be on alert and to inform the hierarchy of the situation which is going on at this border.
Buka did not say how many government troops have been deployed to stop the CAR rebels. He said the troops seized weapons illegally trafficked into Cameroon by the rebels. Cameroon has not given figures on the number of cattle taken by the rebels. The government says economic activity is at a nosedive in Johong and Gawi, villages with the largest cattle market in Mbere. The markets sell about 100 cows a week, down from at least 1,000 every week last year. Cattle ranchers accuse the rebels of either stealing money and their cows or the fear of being tortured. Buyers say they can no longer stop in border markets with the CAR for fear they will be abducted or their money taken. Umaru Isama is mayor of Johong. He says civilians are held in the bush for several weeks until their families pay ransom to the rebels. He says CAR rebels are escaping heavy fighting with government troops and crossing with weapons into Johong. He says the fighting is increasing the number of displaced persons from the CAR escaping post-election violence. He spoke by the messaging app WhatsApp from Johong. Isama says civilians at Cameroon's border village of Yamba near Johong suffer most from the fighting in neighboring CAR. He says since June 15, 3,000 of the 6,500 people living in Yamba are displaced persons from CAR. He says the host community and displaced persons are again witnessing regular fighting over lodging, water, food, and farmland. Mbere is home to 21,000 people displaced due to the crisis in the CAR. 7,000 of the displaced persons had returned to their country but came back to Cameroon within the past 2 months following renewed fighting between CAR rebels and the country's regular troops. Renewed violence erupted in the CAR after the December 2020 elections, in which austere Archange Touadéra was re-elected president. 7 of the CAR's 14 rebel groups refused to recognize Touadéra's victory and have been fighting to seize power. The CAR says much of the fighting is now in border areas where rebels can cross over to neighboring countries due to porous borders. Cameroon shares a 900-kilometer border with the CAR. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The attack in Burkina Faso last month that killed 160 civilians was in retaliation for activity by pro-government civilian militias in the area, according to Human Rights Watch. In this report from Ouagadougou, Henry Wilkins profiles a human rights activist who has been campaigning against abuses committed by those militias for years.
In the daytime, Daouda Diallo is a scientist. By night, he's one of Burkina Faso's most prominent human rights campaigners. He runs the Collective Against Impunity and Stigmatization of Communities, a campaigning group set up in the wake of the Yergo massacre, an attack that saw around 200 people killed, mostly from the Fulani ethnic group, in early 2019. In Burkina Faso's conflict with the Islamic State group and Al-Qaeda, the number of civilians killed by security forces has often come close to the numbers killed by the terror groups. Diallo has been deeply affected by this. I'm a very sensitive person. I like to help the widow and the orphan, the vulnerable. I've devoted my time to this, but it's not an easy job, and I go unpaid. I do it for humanitarian reasons. Diallo also points out that one of the government's most controversial policies is a law that allows pre-existing civilian militias, known as Cogluiegos, to be armed and trained by the government. The new force is called the Volunteers for the Defence of the Homeland, or VDPs. When the law was created in 2020, Human Rights Watch said arming poorly trained civilians could lead to abuses. So far, at least 95 people have been killed in 38 incidents of violence against civilians by VDPs, according to data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. This man, whose name has been withheld to protect his safety, says he watched as VDPs killed two of his neighbours after accusing them of being terrorists. A man named Issa was sick and decided to go to the market. The VDP shot at him there. Issa ran to his house, where they killed him. Bad things happen. That's why I had to run away. The militias are chasing you. The terrorists are chasing you. Burkina Faso's Ministry of Defence did not respond to an interview request about the incident. One VDP leader, who asked to not be named, said most VDPs simply want to defend their homeland, many having had terrifying encounters with terrorists themselves. The terrorists came and burned my house. They were looking for me, but fortunately I was not around. They also killed some of my neighbours and burned their houses as well. It's because of that I really felt I had to join the VDPs. A leader of the ruling MPP party admits it's possible VDPs commit abuses, but says they're necessary. Within the framework of the fight against terrorism, we're obliged to face the fact that the VDPs make a very big contribution. As widespread protests against insecurity in Burkina Faso have swept the country in recent weeks, President Rochemarc Christian Kabore said he'll reform the VDPs as one way of improving security. Diallo says the government should take corrective action quickly. However, the government has yet to say what its action will be. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
American-born swimmer Sepewi Baleka had an illustrious swimming and fitness career, swimming at Yale University and writing a book on fitness, and he thought his Olympic hopeful days were behind him until he visited Guinea-Bissau in 2020 during a trip to see the country where a DNA test revealed he had ancestral roots. Baleka tells Ricky Stryak about how a fateful meeting led him to a new dream of swimming for Guinea-Bissau in this year's Olympics. Despite competing in an Olympic qualifying event earlier this era and meeting the requirements, the Guinea-Bissau Swim Federation says the International Swimming Federation has at the last minute unjustly rejected Balika's qualification, and they are fighting to get him to Tokyo.
The fact that I'm even here in Guinea-Bissau is a miracle in and of itself. Because like most African-American people, you know, I had an ancestor that was kidnapped and trafficked across an ocean and put through a dehumanization process and enslaved with the intention of destroying my cultural identity and making sure I never discovered where I came from and never returned. Because of genetic testing, though, I was able to actually find out that my ancestors are the Balanta people. They live in, you know, a territory that's in what's modern day Guinea-Bissau. Just the fact that after eight generations of ethnocide in America, that I could recover my ancestral and cultural identity and return to my ancestral homeland, that's a miracle. My first visit came in January of 2020. And at that time, the Minister of Sport asked me, you know, how would I like to represent Guinea-Bissau in the Olympics? And so that's really how this opportunity came about. It wasn't something I was seeking.
What has it been like training in Guinea-Bissau?
There's a couple of different aspects. Just being in Guinea-Bissau and riding my bicycle from where I live in Bairro Militar to the Hotel Ledger swimming pool, that's one of the most joyful experiences that I have every day. I get a chance to see the great people of Guinea-Bissau, these great communities. When I go to the pool, that affects me. It makes me feel so grateful. And it puts everything in perspective that my swimming and even this opportunity to go to the Olympics is just really a small thing and doesn't even compare to the things that the people of Guinea-Bissau are facing. And they do it with such grace and patience. But as far as actual swim training, I mean, it's very challenging. I'm swimming in a hotel pool that doesn't have any lane ropes. It doesn't have any lane markers. The water temperature is extremely warm, which makes competitive swim training very, very difficult.
What do you hope to accomplish in Tokyo?
So the main point is for me to use this opportunity to make a contribution to the people of Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Bissau has only been competing in the Olympics since 2008. And in Rio, I believe they only sent like five athletes. So the Olympic movement in Guinea-Bissau is still very young. And as you know, there's very little sports infrastructure, very little opportunities for young people in Guinea-Bissau develop and be competitive in world athletics. And a lot of the best athletes have to leave Guinea-Bissau. So my whole intention was whatever attention I get is one to highlight the great people of Guinea-Bissau, make them proud, but then talk about why it's so difficult for this small country to produce Olympic athletes. And more importantly, to do something about it.
That was swimmer Sepewe Balika. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Bissau. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Tracy Carter, sitting in this morning for Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.